Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, and art. I'm your co-host, Eric Kessel, and I'm here as always with my co-host, Emiliano Gandolfi.
Hello to everybody. Welcome to the show.
We're really excited to be starting a whole new segment, a whole new question here on Social Design Insights. Does design create politics or vice versa? We've been looking at this issue indirectly all year long, and we're excited to finally be focusing on it and asking ourselves some tough questions. Politics determines space. We all know that through land use planning and zoning. Various policies create the form of our buildings and the form of our cities. But in many ways, the form of our buildings and cities creates its own politics, its own life, and creates cycles which are either positive and self-reinforcing and beneficial for humanity, or its opposite. So we've got a great roster of guests for the entire month, and two really special ones today. Emiliano, do you want to introduce them?
Sure. Today we're going to be speaking with Catherine Ewing and Don Shea. Catherine is one of the directors of the Violence Prevention through Urban Upgrading in Cape Town, and Don Shea is one of the team leaders. What is specifically interesting about this interview is that this group has been really looking at how counteract apartheid planning in South Africa. So somehow they became the mediators between institutions and communities.
Yeah, and we thought it was a wonderful place to start for this question. South Africa has had some of the most turbulent political shifts in our lifetime. Emiliano and I are about the same age, and I think both remember, you know, the ending of apartheid and, you know, the policies that came in and gave rise to space, to new communities. We're going to be talking specifically about the Harare Township in Cape Town and about some of the projects that Violence Prevention through Urban Upgrading actually does in an attempt to level the political landscape.
But what I really think is fundamental of this interview and of VPUU is that they really show what planning is and can be today. So they really show how it's not only about, you know, instigating a plan, but it's really understanding how to get feedback from people, from communities, and how to find a mediation between who's planning and has an overall economic understanding of a city and who's actually living on the street. So what is ultimately, I think, fundamental of the work is that they're really innovating somehow what planning is and really looking how changing a mindset around planning, but also changing the mindset of communities or how to inhabit their own environment.
If you listen close, they really, they don't speak directly on it, but it becomes super clear. This distinction between a sort of old model of planning where, you know, a bunch of, you know, figures in power sat along and drew lines on a map. And this new form of planning, which is rooted in the ground and takes place in communities and soccer pitches and people's homes. And it's a wonderful process and a wonderful commentary.
But let's listen to the interview. I think it's an important one.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show, Catherine and Don. We're really pleased to hear more about the violence prevention through urban upgrading from Cape Town. As we heard that many times, that it's becoming a reference on how to restore a situation of development that comes from within a community. So we wanted to hear a bit how the entire project started. I mean, which were the challenges that Cape Town was facing and how VPUU came together as trying to define solutions?
The Violence Prevention through Urban Upgrading program started in 2005, and it was structured into three phases that were over a series of years. But I think the fundamental starting point was around this issue of safety and where one first looked at where was the biggest need for safety. Khayelitsha was where it all started. That became the safe node area in Harare, so a particular township in Khayelitsha known as Harare. So we're currently in phase four of the project, so that's after 10 years. And I think each phase had a different way of working through the process and also how we've actually started working in other areas through the process. So the actual replication of the Violence Prevention through Urban Upgrading program. Khayelitsha is predominantly a low-rise residential area, but it's got large tracts of underutilized land, poorly maintained open spaces, unsafe pedestrian routes, and I think the desire and the need for something that was improved the quality of life of the residents of Khayelitsha was really important as a starting point.
Catherine, for the listeners that don't know specifically Cape Town, can you tell us a bit more about the context?
The context of Khayelitsha in particular, I mean, there's large amount of vulnerable groups, particularly children and youth, and about the lack of social environment in which these children can grow up and the youth can actually get off the streets and actually do something that is not around crime-related issues. Khayelitsha also has a lot of lack of the basic services, particularly in the informal areas in Khayelitsha. That also links to the underemployment, not so much unemployment, but the underemployment of people, or the access to opportunity. Cape Town, of course, has a history of apartheid planning, and Khayelitsha is 35 kilometers outside of any kind of city, sort of the CBD, the center of the city. So you're starting with a spatial challenge up front. And that automatically gives you social exclusion and economic exclusion through that process.
Khayelitsha means new home in the local language, Xhosa. And it was, the apartheid government just moving people away from the urban centers into this residential dormitory of sorts, a labor dormitory. And it's a range of formal one-story houses and a lot of shacks. And it's just a sprawling area of 500,000 people. And so just to start to create some coherent neighborhoods and decent things, it's just going to take time. And that's the apartheid government wasn't so worried about that.
Could you also tell us about how the various groups came together in light of these challenges that you just described? We know that this is a partnership between the city of Cape Town and the German Development Bank and various NGOs. How did you originally get everyone politically and socially aligned to confront these problems in this certain way?
In the late 90s, there was a local 21 agenda workshop in Khayelitsha organized. I don't even know all the organizers, City of Cape Town and some German groups, German government groups and NGO groups. And the Khayelitsha Development Forum, a very organized local structure in that meeting, said, we really want to do something significant for our community. And so some of the seeds of it were planted there. Then there were follow-up background research done by the city and by some German funding, and some different concepts emerged. And Katie, maybe you can fill in the details here, but the German Development Bank and the South African government agreed to work on some projects together with the Khayelitsha Development Forum and BPU as key anchors.
I suppose bringing all these partners together is never an easy task, and there are many voices involved in setting up such a kind of a group of stakeholders. And I think what was important in this is that Sun Development were the implementing agent in the beginning, where their key role was to facilitate. So be the person in the middle, the intermediary, the connecting point between the government and the community, and bringing the two partners together was really important. Community at the core, but not forgetting that government involvement is fundamental to be able to move the sustainability of the project together.
So we saw in also looking at other projects and specifically other honorees of the Corisson Design Prize that it is an essential component, the one to create a mediation between government and local population. Even though we know that working with locals is always quite difficult, because especially in cases of facing crime, segregation, people that have really difficult access to education can sometimes be challenging. So what kind of methodologies are you using to involve people in having a voice?
We start with a social compact. So we always start with the issues on the ground and hearing the voices of the community. And that involves many different community stakeholders. There's not just one group of community. When we say community, it's often many, many role players on the ground as well. We start by working with identifying the issues, and it's often also looking then at needs-based, and then developing what is known as a community action plan. We have a lot of terminologies in our organization, so that's known as a CAP. It's an agreement with the community, so it actually becomes more like a contract, and it almost is understood as a local version of what the government referred to as the IDP, but it comes from the community perspective. Then we try and get government departments involved. So you can then start allocating some budgets or champions or so you make it more real. That is always a starting point. But at the same time, we've got to get on the ground and we've got to actually really understand the environment, which involves a lot of mapping, crime mapping, as well as also just gathering information, gathering data, understanding the situation as it is. Because often when you sit behind a desk, you see a very different story to what you do when you're on the ground.
I think one of the tricky elements is we will work with an officially elected ward development forum of community leaders, but we then insist on adding in the ladies who run the creches, early childhood development centers, the youth sports people, some education sector people, faith leaders. All those people must also form part of the leadership. So you get the political stuff, but you get the other mature people in the community. And then you have lots of workshops with those groups. So that mixture helps a lot to break down some of those bottlenecks you're talking about.
So it sounds like the mapping, the community work, and this mixture that you're referring to, it's politics at the ground level that then filters up into policy. Would that be accurate to say?
That sounds about right. I think we really struggle in South Africa with that we have very good policy. But sometimes the reality on the ground is often miles away from what that policy actually tries to drive. So we certainly try and drive it from the bottom and to actually be able to then enable more appropriate policy. But that doesn't just mean spatial policy. I think it goes across, you know, working with early childhood development policy, which is not often something as an architect you train to actually be able to do. Those aspects to actually make them ingrained in government is just as important.
And specifically in the project in Caliche, so in Harare, I have the impression that there was a very big investment in creating public space. So creating also space for community, but specifically also parks for kids, right?
That's absolutely correct. One of my favorite areas is known as Harare Urban Park. It was an open land as a stormwater detention pond. The primary aspect about what it does is it creates a safe pedestrian walkway. So the public space is actually part of the walkway now. It has a playground there with lights so the children can play at nighttime. It's very exciting when you see spaces activated by young children at night.
What has been the cumulative effect of these sorts of projects? When you transform a stormwater retention pond into a 24-hour park for children, what effect does that have on a community?
One of the million rand questions or million dollar questions is, what is your impact and what's the return on investment? So we partly want to look at, is it reducing the murder rates in a community? Are you actually making a dent on one measurable indicator of violence? So that's kind of a harsh measure. We've had the University of Cape Town Department of Public Health kind of try to look at what's the impact of these big scale programs. And there are reductions in violence. Incidents of crime have reduced. There's one in all of Khayelitsha, one in four people experience getting robbed or some kind of violence or crime in the public space. In our areas, it's much less than that. So that's one example.
It's very hard to measure impact in terms of quality of life, whether people feel safer. But I feel just by watching people walk through the Harare Open Park, you can see that they're maybe not watching over their back as much as they were. They let their children go out and play in the playground. They know that there are eyes on the street. We inverted the public space, so it's not the back end of the space. It actually has visual onto it. So for me, if you can let your child go and play in the playground, that must be some form of improved quality of life.
And is there a direct connection between the design of public space? So do you see in a way in which public participation has an impact on design? And do you see this design being more effective of a conventional park that is designed by an urban office without this kind of process?
So, I mean, the community, one of the first things, how do you make it safe to walk from the train station through to an informal settlement area through a kilometer where there's lots of crime? So one of their ideas was, let's make two-story little tower blocks where the neighborhood watches can be in the top rooms and help watch. And then there's volunteer local neighborhood watches who watch over the areas. The traders, who we designed a traders facility for informal traders, made a lot of suggestions that we need more of this and less of this, and please make sure our sewing co-op can have a space in the top. And so there's a lot of input in design from the community.
I want to switch to Lotus Park informal settlement here, because I think that that was an amazing learning curve in terms of we managed to get some extra funding that we weren't expecting. And then so we said to the community, what would you like? So they said that they would like a basketball court. So we then made sure that everybody else was involved in there, and everybody kept saying no, they wanted a basketball court. So we said, okay, let's put in a basketball court. So we put in the basketball court, and within the first week, I think the girls had taken over the basketball court for netball, and it was a fantastic way that actually, in terms of the community coming up with their ideals, when the reality came, it was also something that was flexible enough that it could allow for many different things. Now that basketball court come netball court come soccer field that it does function as, and it also functions for little kids to ride their bikes around and all sorts of things, we almost are too predictive in our design. And the beauty around some of these public spaces is that you learn so much through just actually seeing how people use space. And I think all too often we predict how people use space.
We hope you're enjoying this interview with Violence Prevention and Urban Upgrading. And we're only just getting into it, but we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get down to some serious brass tacks with Catherine and Don, including talking about comprehensive neighborhood development and how to achieve financial sustainability with these projects. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights.
Welcome back to Social Design Insights. We are continuing our insightful conversation with Catherine Ewing and Don Shea of Violence Prevention through Urban Upgrading in Cape Town. After looking at the origins and at the methodology of this groundbreaking organization, we will be speaking more about their strategy in activating public space and what lessons they've learned working with communities.
It sounds like you're talking about a method of design that relies on a certain self-determination. And I think we have this sort of shared legacy of the 20th century where, you know, designers would be predictive. They would say, you know, I'm going to design this space and therefore people are going to use it in such and such a way. And so many of those experiments failed. But if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like what you're advocating is to design in such a way that people can determine how they use the space. There's a flexibility that allows them to own it and make it theirs. Is that right?
I suppose that is what I'm trying to get at, but I suppose it's also allowing the flexibility. So what are your ground rules for design for public space? And where do you let go? I think some of the kind of the ground rules that we try and work with, so the distance. So at 30 meters, you can see somebody's face and you could make out who's coming towards you. More than 30 meters and our public spaces are then, you know, then you do need to set up some framework to them. So you guide and direct. But some of the smaller spaces that we work in have the most amazing ability to be 40 square meters that actually acts as a public space. So in determining design, I suppose, yes, then that people using the space, they use it in so many different ways that sometimes just defining an edge just helps from a design perspective. But on some of the public spaces, we often go and observe how people use the space first. And then we come back and then we put in some benches or even some of them we put in some trees. In the bigger spaces, it's a bit more difficult because you set a framework for design.
Is it different in a place as the Caliche that was more somehow formalized, even if in low scale, and a place as Lotus Park that is an informal settlement, so completely self-built by its inhabitants?
Public space in informal areas is high value because, of course, it's land that can be used for habitation. Whereas in Khayelitsha, what we had was a scenario where we had huge tracts of vast open land that were vacant, underutilized crime hotspots that people still walked through, but people were not safe in. So the difference between the two was that it's a very different context. So how one worked with the public space was also quite different. And also working with what the community wanted. In the Harare urban park, there is an NGO called Grassroots Soccer, and they have a small little five-a-side football field. So with lights, and that's activated 18 hours of the day. So there's eyes on the street as well in that space. It has a playground, it has a grass field, it has a walkway, whereas in the informal settlements, they're much smaller and they're generally focused around water points. So collection points, gathering points. The local community know them as Mtonjeni, a local public gathering space that has water, a water fountain.
In Greater Cape Town, there's over 300 informal settlements. So it's a massive part of South Africa's challenges. Many of the cities haven't really recognized informal settlements because the assumption is we're going to get formal housing for all these people eventually. Recently, it's clear that that's not going to happen. It's just the housing backlogs are so great. So now into the informal settlements we're working in, we're able to kind of work with the city to start to, we've actually built some buildings in the informal settlements, which the city didn't want to do, small community centers. So that's another big difference is your institutional framework and trying to help a big municipality realize you've got to try some different things here.
And Don, what is the value of having a community center and informal settlement? Because I think that you're working on different fronts. Of course, you're trying to prevent crime, but you're creating hubs for education, but also specifically you're trying to create new sources of employment, right?
Violence prevention and preventing crime is an interesting title, but what we really do is comprehensive community development. How do you help create decent, nice neighborhoods that were used to be labor dormitories? How do you make a nice neighborhood? And part of making it nice is making it safe, looking for links to jobs and training and education, making it safe for kids, fun for families. So it's all that stuff. We're involved in all of that.
You have a neighborhood center in Lotus Park. So what is this for? How does it work?
The Lotus Park Neighborhood Center, it has a variation of function. Core to that is the community register office. So the community register office deals with administrative recognition. So looking at the 10-year situation and creating an updated database of people who are living in the informal settlement. So that's a grounding kind of basis that is at the core of the Lotus Park Neighborhood Center. Along with, there's a toy library, an early childhood development toy library. There's a youth center, and then the youth have also created a little gym for themselves. So they don't only have to go there and do their homework. There's a community hall that can also be rented out. We actually use the hall quite a bit for training as well as general meetings. The leadership have the Safe Node Area Committee have an office there. And then there's a small sewing group that are located at the office. We have a couple of spaces where you can also have, so other NGOs could come in, at gender-based violence or legal aid or anything to do with assisting the broader aspect around prevention.
Government health services the government wants to provide also will come there for a day. So you can come to a health clinic for a day. So it's partly a way to bring government closer to people. To spend 5-10 rands to take taxis to go to town is some people can't afford that. So it's just nicer to get services closer to people.
So does Lotus Park represent some kind of evolution in the VPUU model? I mean, let me put it differently. What does the future hold for VPUU and ongoing projects?
Currently, I think the Lotus Park shows how we can work through a process in an informal settlement. So it's the application of the methodology and the strategy, the VPU strategy, into an informal settlement, where of course you have different demands and different needs, but it was also the kind of the start of the replication of the VPU methodology. We're currently working with the Western Cape government in towns outside of Cape Town metropole. So we're working in Villiersdorp and Paarl. The idea is to see how it can work in different environments, with community participation at the core and driving the needs basis of it. Villiersdorp is a little rural town. Paarl is a medium-sized town on the edge of Cape Town, and in the informal settlement. So we've got different sort of safe node areas that we work in, and they're all very different.
I think it's really interesting how you're using participation to define, you know, all the variations and the specific local necessities. What I thought was also always incredibly effective and interesting about your process and your project is that specifically in Europe, there was a culture of building infrastructure and social centers in working class neighborhoods. And over the years, especially when neoliberal policies started kicking in the mid-80s, all these places were abandoned and they were not financed anymore. So we're facing sometimes in European peripheries some issues. Well, we have a high crime rate, specifically due to this lack of services that now you're introducing so thoughtfully and so powerfully, because I think that what you're doing is really following an overall strategy, but also being really tactical. So I really think that somehow what you're doing has also something to teach as an approach to design that goes well beyond South Africa. I think it'll be interesting to hear from you if you think that while doing this work, you feel that you have a lesson that you can share.
One of the elements we want to bring into every program is how is this going to be financially sustainable going forward? So we do a lot of multi-use. We don't do single-use buildings. So at a House of Learning library, in the top floor, there's five offices for nonprofit organizations or whatever businesses you could put in there who are paying the rent. There's rooms that we will, like the city would charge a tariff to use, meeting rooms or halls. And we will manage that income. It's not a self-sustaining, fully self-sustaining model, but we're covering about a third of the costs in Harare at the moment. And in Lotus Park, we're trying to get the model. So there's a couple places that local businesses or local NGOs can rent. We're also renting out the hall. So how are you thinking about that longer term sustainability? And are there models where community can manage some of that? Or you could hire in companies who don't really want to make a big profit, but who would want to run community centers in partnership with communities. So that's part of the thinking.
We always start with the early childhood development. So you're setting up a lifelong process in terms of people developing. And by allowing them access to a toy library or to toys that have educational wealth or that make the child think differently, it often kind of helps the journey to start for innovation. And a lot of that is changing mindsets. So like Don was referring to, how do we create this long-term sustainability? I think all too often in South Africa, the government has provided. So this is a big change in a mindset where everybody has to put in their fair share. So we can't just come along and provide, and the government doesn't come and provide, and the community doesn't also just sit back. So I think that for a big lesson for me is you start with the young children is an amazing place to start. But it's also about these changing mindsets and listening to all the role players. And that includes the government and the community and the stakeholders and the councillors and the politicians for those lessons in moving forward.
Thank you, Catherine, Don. I think that's a very poetic place to close this idea of drawing everyone together into one discourse and letting that inform a spatial development strategy. We really appreciate your time. We think this is a wonderful way to kick off our latest segment and to understand how progressive groups like yours actually navigate these situations on the ground.
Thank you very much. It's a highly complicated process to try and put down, but...
Yes, it is.
Thanks so much for both your interest and for how seriously you take, just looking at other people's work. I appreciate it very much. We're honored. So thank you.
It's a true pleasure. And I really hope that everybody that is interested can go to your website. That is vpuu.org.za. Because it's a really comprehensive website that talks better about, you know, your aims and your methodology and shows much more comprehensively all the projects. So I hope that, you know, who's interested will take time to study better your work, because it's a true inspiration. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And this is all for this episode. Please stay tuned for the release of the other episodes on Does Design Create Politics or Vice Versa? We will be interviewing Stalker, Vera and Rudy Bauer, Adbusters, and Iconoclasistas. And we also have more practices that we're honoring this month, as Arquitectura Colectivas, Stealth Unlimited, Think Public, Usina de Trabajo para un Centro Habitado, and Plant Silva. Please check our website, currystonedesignprize.com, to find out more details about our work, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to stay continuously updated. Social Design Insight is a program by the Curry Stone Design Prize. We really hope you enjoyed the show and that you will help us spread the social design agenda in your own community. Thank you for listening to Social Design Insights. We'll be right back.